Right. Well, good afternoon again to everybody. You've hit the right website. This is Staging Piety, the Taqiyya Mu'adhan al-Mulk and Kerman Shah with Dr. Nahida Asami here on the 3rd of April, 2024 for our April seminar for the British Institute of Persian Studies. Dr. Asami is an independent scholar who specializes in the art and architectural history of Qajar, Iran. She has published articles in the peer-reviewed journal Iran. She holds a PhD from the Courtauld Institute of Art in London, an MA in Islamic Art and Archaeology from the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, and she has an MA in Fine Arts from the, and I'm going to mangle the French, for which I apologize, the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris, where she was trained as a classical artist. She is also a miniaturist, an illuminator, and a calligrapher working on commission. And with that, I'm going to turn over to Dr. Asami.
Okay, thank you, Professor Newman, for the introduction. And I would also like to thank BIPS for the opportunity of giving this presentation. Taqiyyas in their Iranian incarnation are spaces dedicated to the commemorative rituals of the Battle of Karbala. They are either temporary structures set up for the duration of the 10-day period of the mourning ritual of Muharram, or permanent ones built by religious organizations. In their private capacity, they date to the Qajar period. Taqiyya Mu'adhan al-Mulk in Kermanshah, a late Qajar complex, is one such space. The battle took place at the plain of Karbala on the 10th of October 680, 10th of Muharram 61, between the army of the Umayyad caliphs Yazid ibn Muawiyah and the small army of Hussein ibn Ali, the Prophet Muhammad's grandson and the third Shi'i imam, during which they were all massacred. Considered as martyrdom, the event is of great symbolic significance to the Shi'i world and constitutes the foundation of the community's sense of unity and identity. To keep the memory alive and prevent the Shi'i past to die over time, history has been changed into tradition and commemorative rituals, and is performed with intense emotion on each anniversary of the event. The quoted passage on the screen, attributed to Imam Reza, the eighth of the Shiite Imams, encapsulates this fundamental tenet of Imami Shi'ism in its lamentation over the tragedy of Hussein at Karbala. As a 17th century source of authority indicates, the event of Karbala has survived in the collective memory of the Shiites well into the present era. The Husseiniyyah of the Taqiyya Mu'adhan al-Mulk is accordingly furnished with two panels. One depicts the scene of moving the women folk from the Qatlgah, the place of martyrdom in Karbala. The other represents the ritual sermon of Ruzekhani, the specifically Shiite ritual sermon that incorporates the procession of flagellants as well. Both glazed tiled panels reinterpret in pictorial terms the quoted passage, visualizing the account of the grief over the tragedy of Karbala. The building of a Taqiyya, a Husseiniyyah, and the representations on tiled panels on those events in early 20th century underscores the deep-rooted longevity of these dramatic events in popular imagination of Iranian Shi'ism. It was through moving from the Qatlgah that the women came upon the mutilated and beheaded bodies of their menfolk, pierced with multitude of arrows, trampled under horses' hooves. Seeing their decapitated heads unspiked as trophies of the battle, paraded by the enemy, and the indignities endured by themselves, beaten and dragged on foot across the plains of Karbala, they mourned their loss, lamented their departed ones, and cried for vengeance. So started the ritual of commemoration, a practice that has continued for 14 centuries, as depicted on the panel of Ruzekhani. The panel interprets the event as it takes place in the proper space of the Husseiniyyah, the destination for the processionals, where together with other spectators, all townsfolk come to witness the history being dramatized with unfolding public lamentations through the performance of the storyteller Rose Khan, who brings the emotional power of the drama depicted on the wall to the fore by engaging the audience with the event through recital of the story and his sermon. With a mixture of recitation in prose and poetry and dramatic intonation and modulation of voice, the Rose Khan moves his audience through time and space to make the emotive story current, palpable, even alive before their eyes. Rose Khan is thus able to excite, instruct, and manipulate the emotions of his audience, cause the greatest wailing and weeping, and incite a sense of shared grief. In the performances at the Husseinieh, the community takes a shape through the intensity of the focus of remembered sorrow. The performance over, conviviality begins as participants are provided food and drink. A community has been brought together, cultural forms and values instilled, and a sense of solidarity and identity achieved, all through the agency of a wealthy merchant, providing the space for the religious performance and the subsequent feast for the multitudes. Much of the rituals we encounter in the Qajar era find their initial articulation in the writing of Hossein Vaizi Kashefi, the Timurid theologian philosopher, and his book Rozat al-Shuhada, an Alid martyrology mixing history and legend in a folkloric manner and melodramatic tone, all with the aim of producing empathy and fostering loyalty with the Holy Family through the performance of its stories. The book provided the basis for the stationary ritual of Rose Khani in public gatherings, with its imagery contributing to the development of the ambulatory ritual of daste or procession and shabih or tableau vivant in the streets and urban squares, which from simple wailing and self-flagellations by individuals in the early 16th century, as reported by European travelers to Iran, developed into elaborate pageants terminating in fire displays and jubilation by the end of the 17th century, all encouraged by religious jurists and sponsored by the state as a tool for propagation, conversion, and consolidation of the new state creed instituted by the Safavids. Such annual commemorations provided a strong symbolic basis for unity in the community and fostered a sense of belonging. Through mixture of cathartic experience followed by jubilation, the populace kept coming every year, renewing their allegiance to the Karbala martyrs, making the rituals the most conspicuous spectacle in the cultural life of Iran. In Safavid Isfahan, these ceremonies were centered in the space of the Meydan-e Naqsh-e-Jahan, the celebrated public square built for Shah Abbas's new capital, where the Shah would watch the processions from the dominating position of the upper talar of the Ali Qapu, the architectural symbol of both royal and religious power, presenting the royal support for the religious performances to his subjects, fusing notions of rule and authority with popular engagement. In practice, the square during such ceremonies functioned as a tekkiyeh, with its walls and open places dressed up as one giant stage for the performances. By the time of the Qajar rule, Shi'ism had become so deeply rooted and pervasive as to have its ritual practices and symbols permeate all aspects of social life, with the otherworldly nature of Shi'ism promoted by theologians since the late 17th century, having a firm hold on the psyche of the common man who now visited shrines of the imams and their descendants, participated in mourning rituals of Muharram, and attended the theatrical performances of the Battle of Karbala called Taziyeh, which had been developed towards the end of the 18th century. By virtue of the Karbala stories depicted on its wall, Tekkiye Muavin al-Mulk was also perceived as a holy site worthy of visitation, where the pious locals flocked to visit Hussein, paying him their allegiance, seeking barakat, and hoping for intercession on their behalf on the hereafter. In 1868, in an attempt to foster loyalty to his person by providing entertainment to the masses, Nasiruddin Shah built the most sumptuous theater, the Tekkiye Dolat, for the performance of the Muharram rituals and Taziyeh, an exercise that gave him the chance to display his dedication to Shi'ism and the martyrs of Karbala in full view of the multitudes. The painting of the Tekkiye Dolat on the screen is the visual record of the annual remembrance of Karbala provided by the monarch, with pomp and circumstance, mixing processionals and the stationary theatricals of Rozekhani and Taziyeh, incorporating thousands of casts, both human and animal, dazzling the eyes of the spectators to mobilize support and legitimize the king's rule and power as the shadow of God on earth. The monarchical exercise of patronizing art from below was followed by the elites and the well-to-do of the society in the capital and the provinces, as exemplified by this tekkiye. The complex of the Tekkiye Muavin al-Mulk started its life in 1912 and was built on the ruins of a previous Husseiniye belonging to his family collectively. The family were one of the ayans or notables of Kermanshah, with considerable influence within the city's social, political, and religious power structure, enjoying loyalty within the urban community, as well as support from a number of leading Kurdish tribes to whom they were related through marriage. Muavin al-Mulk himself was a merchant of considerable wealth and one of the most prominent regional and long-distance traders in the lucrative export of gum, tragacanth, and opium. Building a tekkiye was an exercise in reinforcing and strengthening his social bond with the community within which he lived. As a visible act of piety, it placed him at the heart of the city's sacred symbols. Through provision of pietistic entertainment and feasting of the masses, thus sharing his wealth, he further legitimized his privileged position in a society where riches belonged to a few, often amassed at the expenses of the majority of dispossessed, bringing himself loyalty and adding to his client base. The tekkiye comprises of a forecourt plus three structures named Husseiniye, Zeynabiye, and Abbasiye. Built across the river Absheron, the tekkiye originally stood on a higher plane than the course of the river in an open space. The river had gradually been utilized as a carrier of waste products, becoming polluted and a health hazard. Starting in the 1950s, the whole course of the river passing through the town of Kermanshah was covered up and turned into streets. As a result, the tekkiye is now 3.8 meters below the street level and is boxed in an enclosed space with a small square within which it stood, now its forecourt by default. The entire complex is clad in polychrome tiles of geometric and floral designs, interspersed with narrative panels of Karbala story, with the panels in each space depicting the rituals that will take place in them, taking the visitor step by step through the story. In line with its function as the entrance to the tekkia, the structures within its forecourt are decorated with narrative panels introducing the story of Shi'ism and Karbala. On the entrance facade, the bottom register of the first floor is decorated with four panels depicting various fights. The two on the left portray Ali at the Battle of Trench, fought with the Meccans in 627 and with the Jewish community at Khaybar in 628. These panels represent the important role of Ali and his struggles by the side of the Prophet in the establishment of Islam, a role which was rewarded by the Prophet, designating him as his successor, leading to the doctrine of the Imamate at the core of the Shi'i faith for which the Battle of Karbala was fought. The two panels on the right portray battles being fought by two young warriors with the forces of Yazid at Karbala. Identified as Ali Akbar, the 17-year-old son of Hussein, and Qasim, the 14-year-old son of Hassan, the second Shi'i Imam. The aim is to emphasize the courage and bravery of the two young men fighting so heroically versus the cowardice of the cruel and heartless enemy engaging in an unequal battle. On the opposite side of the facade is a water reservoir, Kum Saqokhane, decorated with the image of Abbas, Hussein's half-brother, and Sakine, Hussein's daughter, asking him for water. Abbas is known as the Karbala's water carrier for his efforts to bring water to the besieged camp, which had been denied water. As Hussein and his followers were killed in the hot, dry plain of Karbala, water and thirst has assumed iconic significance for the Shi'is, with Saqokhanes dedicated to the memory of Abbas and given as wax. The theme of water and thirst thus runs through other spaces of the tekkia as a constant reminder of the tragedy. The entrance portal is framed by small narrative panels of the Karbala story, including the shrines of Hussein and Abbas. At the apex of the frame, two flying angels hold a crown. An old photograph shows the tympanum of the portal, originally decorated with tiles featuring a centerpiece with a halo with a haloed seated figure and two flying angels hovering above. The seated figure clearly represented Hussein, with a crown held over his head, confirming his position as the king of martyrs, or Shah-e-Shahidan, with his central position reflecting his centrality within Shi'i theology and ritual practice, thus setting the scene for entrance into the complex. A short vestibule leads into the space of the Husseinieh, planned on a typical residential house of the period, a courtyard surrounded by a two-story building. The Husseinieh is a stand-in for the place of martyrdom, as seen through the images on its wall. It further symbolizes Hussein's burial place, later his shrine, where penitents come to visit and mourn his death every year, a practice simulating a pilgrimage to a shrine. This finds confirmation in the Ziyaratname, a form of litany used during visits to sacred sites, especially Shi'i shrines, written on the panel of Rozekhani. The Husseiniyeh leads to the Zainabiyeh, an octagonal shaped space with an open core and eight solid or hollow volumes around it. It is surmounted by galleries on its north and south sides, supporting a 16-sided zone of transition below a double shell dome, and is clad entirely in glazed bricks and polychrome tile panels. Glazed bricks are imaginatively used to decorate all the walls and chromatic radiating design with chromatic radiating designs, conjuring in the mind the idea of the sun and the celestial glow. The clerestory zone is divided into 8 narrative panels depicting stories from the Quran and the Hadith, separated by 8 windows in stained glass, providing light to the dome area. Within the central space, 10 large narrative panels depict on the main the aftermath of the events with Zainab, Hussein's sister, as the protagonist. Hence the name Zainabiyya. Zainab is credited not only for lending support to her brother during the battle, becoming the leader of the group of women and orphans after the event, but for her role in propagation of the Karbala message. The sermon given to the treacherous Kufan, who had lured Hussein to Karbala only to abandon him in his hour of need, and her confrontation with Yazid at his court, causing him remorse for the wrong done, allowing the Ahl al-Bayt to return home to Medina, releasing them, the head of Hussein, brought to him as trophy of the battle so that it can be joined with the body, giving him a dignified burial. On the bottom half of a panel, we thus see Hussein's elder son, Zain al-Abidin, now the new Imam, together with a group of men with shovels, in the act of burial of the headless bodies strewn on the ground. This is 40 days after the massacre, known as the Arba'in. Legend has it that Hussein's headless body was placed on a stretcher made of leaves of a date palm tree and moved under the shade until burial. With Zain al-Abidin seen here at the act of burial, the Zainabiyya can be equated with Hussein's burial place, later his shrine. The shaded space of the Zainabiyya is domical, octagonal, and honorific form of structure common to funerary monuments. The need to walk around the space to view the narrative panels of the story, thus a circumambulation, give credence to its symbolism as Hussein's tomb and shrine. The symbolism is reinforced by the presence of Muawin al-Mulk's mausoleum within the Zainabiyya. The desire to be buried at Karbala near the tomb of Hussein, where barakat is confirmed, is strong within Shi'i consciousness. It is believed the 12th Imam Mahdi will appear at Karbala, and those buried there will be resurrected as part of his army. Transportation of the dead to Karbala for burial was a profitable industry in the Qajar era, and especially for Kermanshah as the last stopping place en route to Karbala. Two of Muawin al-Mulk's brothers who had passed before him were buried at Karbala, yet he chose to be buried under the dome of the Zainabiyya. Perhaps he equated the space with that of Hussein's tomb at Karbala, and therefore an equally holy place. At such proximity to Hussein's tomb, intimate contact with the Imam was made, and many rewards gained, not least that of preservation of his own memory for posterity. Now, 19th century Iran was made up of a collection of different ethnicities. Loyalty rested in group affinity and not the geographic land of Iran. The creation of national identity and the enterprise of nationhood was a multifaceted exercise undertaken by the Qajars, especially in the latter part of the 19th century and into the early 20th. Marvin al-Mulk's investment in constructing a tekkiyeh was a step towards formation of a sense of nationhood achieved through the consolidation of Iran's Shi'i religious identity. Within his tekkiyeh, cultural and religious values were shared, loyalty fostered, and a sense of solidarity and communal identity created. Now, living in Kermanshah, one of the cradles of the country's history and culture, with the pre-Islamic monuments of Bishutun and Tagh-e Bostan looming large on its landscape, a place of importance to the struggle for constitutionalism and a playground of the foreign powers threatening the sovereignty of the country, the patron seems to have also been conscious of the need to engage the tekkiyeh's visitor with a different, more powerful set of coordinates in formation of identity, an exercise implemented in the complex's third space, the Abbasiyeh. The Abbasiyeh visibly speaks to the viewer of a new set of ideas, sentiments, and modes of expression. It was built and decorated circa 1918 to 1926, the period of post-constitution and post-World War I, when the country was on the verge of disintegration, faced with revolutionary upheaval, socio-political disorder, and the encroachment of foreign powers into its affairs, giving rise to the need for formation of a new form of identity for the Iranians, away from its Islamic ones, with concerted efforts made by intellectuals to emphasize and reconstruct Iran's glorious pre-Islamic history, thereby creating new bases for national identity. Three large panels decorate the north wall of the Abbasiyeh, consisting of a series of underglazed painted tiles with figures molded in white relief, copied from Iran's pre-Islamic monuments of Persepolis, Naqsh-e Rajab, Bishapur, Bishutun, and Tagh-e Bostan, a bit at awakening the visitor's national memory with respect to history, culture, and identity, helping to create new communities of belonging, shifting the loyalty to Hussein to a different set of coordinates. The three panels are further framed with a series of tiles recording portraits of kings, also found on the dados of the other spaces, copied from Jalaluddin Mirza Qajar's Name Khosrovan, the first nationalistic history book of Iran. They are in star-shaped frames reminiscent of those of the Ilkhani period, now rendered in shaded and hatched monochrome sepia, numbered and identified with inscription. There is a pedagogical aspect to these portrayals, also true of the ancient Persia panels. Interspersed with tiles of architectural or literary motifs, they direct the viewer both visually and epigraphically to their source for further investigation. The portrait of the kings and rulers of Iran, sequentially numbered, is a visual rendering of the history of Iran. The depiction of heroes and literary protagonists celebrate Iran's notable literary culture. The interest in history, artistic, and literary culture of Iran is not limited to the past, but includes the contemporary social history of Iran. In this respect, a series of tiles depicting prominent members of Iranian society, both religious and political, adorn the space of the Abbasiyeh, identified through inscriptions. These are mainly of Kermanshahi notables of pro-constitutional leaning, pointing to an attempt at portraying a comprehensive story of the constitution and its reception in Kermanshah by various groups, for or against, as comprehensively as possible. In line with the religious function of the tekke, a significant number of these portrait tiles depict religious figures, not all contemporary. A number are from the past, chosen perhaps as an overview of the religious history of Islamic Iran. Included are such luminaries as Muhammad Baqir Majlisi, the celebrated Hadith scholar of Imami Shiism of the Safavid era, and Sheikh Ahmad Ahsai, founder of the school of Sheikhism, whose thoughts on Shiism, the occultation of the last Imam, and especially the nature of religious authority was detrimental to Shi'i orthodoxy. The inclusion of the two side by side underscores the enlightened attitude of the patron and his advisors towards the socio-religious culture of the time. The characteristic features of the contemporary figures is the realism, peculiar to the Qajar art of portraiture, and clearly reveals the source of some as photography. Not all are successful. The portrait of Sheikh Ali Asghar is of considerable sophistication, while those of old religious figures at times verge on the comical, pointing to the use of imagination in the absence of photographic model. Despite these occasional shortcomings, the Abbasiyya works as a unique encyclopedia of the religious and political history of Iran and the locality of Kermanshah in Tilewar. The encyclopedic nature of the decoration is not limited to the Abbasiyya, and is present in other spaces of the tekke and encompass even the newsworthy events of the era, especially those dealing with the arrival of modernity into the society of the time. In the Husseiniyye, we come across a tile depicting Nasreddin Shah on horseback. The depiction is that of the ruler's bronze equestrian sculpture, a celebratory piece commissioned to coincide with the 40th anniversary of his rule. This was the first equestrian statue of an Islamic ruler erected during his lifetime, an exercise that proved extremely controversial, considered contrary to the dictates of Islam and traditional kingship. Modeled on the European style equestrian statues, it further symbolized foreign intervention in Persian affairs, becoming a hated symbol of Qajar rule, and was subsequently torn down and melted. Some 40 years later, a new equestrian statue of Reza Shah would adorn the central space of the principal square of the capital, by which time modernity had established itself firmly in society and overtaken the traditional nature of the Qajar era. The concept of modernity taking over tradition is beautifully rendered on a tile in the Abbasiyye, depicting a horse-drawn carriage trying to catch up an automobile but being left behind. In 1902, Muzaffaruddin Shah bought two automobiles during his trip to Europe and brought them to Iran. Such a novelty would soon become popular, overtaking the use of the horse-drawn carriages, which had been the traditional means of transportation for the elites of the society. There's even modernity in the Zainabiyye, the most traditional space of the tekke. One day towards the end of 1913, the people of Tehran for the first time saw an airplane flying over the city. Everyone rushed to the street to get a closer look at the strange bird flying. It was a single-seater Blériot 11 flown into Tehran by a Russian pilot. The news of the strange bird must have circulated around the country, for the depiction on the tile is designed clearly an unverbal description of a strange bird with its wings and tails now being flown by a Qajar male figure. To conclude, it was the 19th century common man's belief in the hereafter, his quest for salvation, and the intercessory nature of Ali's descendants, especially Hussein, so central to Shi'i theology and ritual practice that provided the basis for the creation of a shared sense of belonging. Through the theatrics of Taziyeh, rituals of Rozekhani, and performances of the processionals, this community of remembrance became the audience for the Qajar elites, who solicited the loyalty of the broader public by building tekkiyes, providing the venues for pious forms of entertainment. Whether with the political aim of gaining respect and approval from the masses to legitimize their privileged position within the society, or a simple pious act of charity, however one reads the story, in the end, all benefited from such patronage. Above all, identity was formed and the sense of a nation created. Thank you.
That was absolutely terrific. Thank you so very much. I really enjoyed that. Can I ask a particular question about some of the figures in some of the religious figures in the panel? I'm most interested myself, as some may know, in the Safavid period. And while I recognize Majlisi and why he might have been chosen, keep going. Hold on right there. On the top, what I see is left, Sheikh Ahmed Ardabili, Mokhadesa Ardabili. That's very interesting. Is there any record of why certain figures were chosen, or are we left to figure that out ourselves, because there's nothing written down in any kind of a document that would say, here, make sure you do this one, and here's why?
Yeah, no, I mean, unfortunately, there are no records as why these have been chosen. But as I said, I think this is a kind of an overview of the religious climate, Islamic climate of Iran. So, I mean, obviously these are imaginary portraits. You know, they are not accurate ones. But because obviously Sheikh Ahmed Ardabili was a very important jurist, you know, he has been chosen to be portrayed. There are quite a lot of this kind of portrayal, but not all of them. Unfortunately, the majority of tiles have been kind of abused. You know, the names have been rubbed off. And these are the few that I could find with, the names still on the tile. And because they were kind of towards the higher up on the walls.
Right, okay, all right. Okay, I have a question here. Thank you for the first one. Thank you for your wonderful lecture. I wonder if you might know, where do you think the pattern and battle scenes on the entrance facade come from?
Well, there was a tradition of portraying these battle scenes in, you know, lithograph editions of the martyrology, which were very, very popular in the Qajar era. And most probably they come from those sources. And actually, there is a book of martyrology in the library of the Tekkiye. And that one has quite a lot of images in it. It is probably that, you know, the artist used either that book or other sources for I mean, plenty of martyrology, lithographed during the Qajar period.
Right. Okay. Do you see, another question? Do you see distinctions in the subject matter or narrative strategy of the tiles, in contrast to other areas of visual culture where similar events are depicted? For example, later coffeehouse paintings.
No, I mean, you can say that these are kind of extension of the coffeehouse paintings. Of course, the coffeehouse paintings became kind of popular, and the people who practice those kind of paintings, I mean, it dates kind of towards the second half of the 20th century. These are earlier, you know. So, but I'm sure there were plenty of that kind of style going around, you know. The majority of coffeehouse painters of the period, I mean, when I say period of the 20th century, they started their, they were tile designers originally. And obviously, you know, there has to be some kind of connection between the later paintings and these practitioners on tile works.
Okay. Just to follow up on the lithography point, was there a particular lithography volume that you had in mind when you referenced the battle scenes, for example, as coming from a litho?
Well, there are plenty. One of them is, called Tufano. There's a book called Tufanul Boka, the deluge of. I don't know. Sorry, I can't translate it into English right now. But it was such a popular book, more than 15 edition within something like 10 years. So, and basically all these lithographed martyrologies, the images are very much the same, very much the same. And they take the cue, as I said, from the book of the Rosato Shahada, which is, the book Rosato Shahada actually paints pictures in words, if you know what I mean. So very precise about kind of imagining what the scene would be.
Okay, thank you. Got a blitz of questions in only about 5 or so minutes here. A fascinating lecture, thank you. Are there any other tile tekkiyehs from this period in Iran?
From this tekkiyeh?
Other tile tekkiyehs from elsewhere in Iran, from around
the world. I mean, the most famous one was Tekkiyeh Moshir in Shiraz, which had a magnificent kind of what is called Shah Nishin, and with the magnificent tile works of the Battle of Karbala and the Day of Judgment, etc., etc. But unfortunately, it was burnt down. So that was the height of representation of this story on tile works, but unfortunately it doesn't exist anymore. You can find images in other tekkiyehs, especially in the north of Iran, in Gilan and Mazandaran, especially in Gilan, in smaller tekkiyehs or Hosseiniyehs, yes.
Okay.
But, I mean, nothing like this tekkiyeh. Very, very, I mean, one or two tiles here or there.
Okay, thank you very much. Do you find images of Hazrat Ali there, and how authentic are those images?
Well, obviously they're not authentic.
But no, well,
you know, there are three or four images of Hazrat Ali, but they are veiled. He sports a veil. So, and it is only through the inscription that we can see that it is a representation of Hazrat Ali.
Okay. I want to thank everybody, whether you are in the morning or you're in the afternoon, as with us here in rainy Edinburgh, or sunny wherever it is elsewhere in the UK, although I don't think there's any place sunny in the UK today, or further east as well, so in the early evening. Thank you for everybody. And I want to thank you, Dr. Awesome, very much. It's absolutely fascinating. Lots of food for thought here. Lots more questions that I wasn't able to take on. And we want to thank you and thank our audience, and bid everyone either a good morning or a good afternoon or a good evening, depending upon what time zone and where you are.
Thank you.